You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning. It's nice to see you all here this early, and I'm surprised, given normal behavior in Washington, that you're all not in line at the supermarket stocking up on durable goods and other things for the couple of inches of snow that we may get tomorrow. But we're glad that you're here instead. My name's George Perkovich. I'm a director of the Nuclear Policy Program. My job is simple this morning. It's pretty simple all the time, but it's simple this morning because I'm just here to introduce two very good longstanding friends from Pakistan, Pervez Hoodbhoy and Zia Mian. And perhaps most importantly, to introduce them to talk about the book project that they have collaborated in, Confronting the Bomb, Pakistani and Indian Scientists Speak Out. Before I do that more proper introduction, I also should thank the Heinrich Böll Foundation, which is obviously headquartered in Germany, but does a lot of work in South Asia, including in Pakistan. Sebastian Graf is here representing the Böll Foundation. But they, through their offices in Pakistan, made this book possible. And so we're very thankful to them. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and you should infer things between the next that sentence and this sentence. We don't have copies here. We were supposed to have copies here. They are in some form of transit on their way here. But you do have the possibility, and indeed I would encourage you to order the book. There's a table in the back there, so you can order the book, and it will be sent to you, presumably more reliably than it was sent here, but it's a much shorter distance if you're based here. In any case, the book is obtainable either this way or through ordering it from the press, or I assume on Amazon. On Amazon. If I had the book, I would hold it up and show it to you. But I had the pleasure of reading an early draft of it, and it's very impressive. It's a volume of chapters by multiple authors, but it covers civilian nuclear energy, it covers the military program, different aspects of the military program, it covers some of the history. There are also social analyses of the effects of these programs. And as a collection, I think it's the most kind of penetrating that I've seen, perhaps ever, at least for many years, because it's neither kind of cheerleading, which is what one normally gets, nor kind of unreflective criticism or bashing. It's very thoughtful analyses of these two programs from multiple dimensions. So I really do encourage you all to take advantage of the book and obtain it and read it. Let me begin by introducing Zia Mian, who's going to talk about this project and also, in bigger background, the project that he heads at Princeton University, the project on peace and security in South Asia. And it was in this auspice that the book sprang. Zia is known to many, if not all of you here. He's been at Princeton for more than a decade. He's a physicist. He's also he's the most literate person I know, which says something, but actually doesn't say anything about the company I keep, because I know a lot of literate people, actually. I know people who've written books that aren't nuclear books. Some novels and stuff, but he is the most literate person I know. If you ever have to have anything edited, he's the guy. It will be very critical, but it will be extremely informed by literature on all subjects. And he brings those diverse interests and that great learnedness to the study of things nuclear, and so he's a real asset for all of us working in this field. He's the associate editor of Science and Global Security, which is an international peer-reviewed scientific and technical journal on issues related to arms control, disarmament, and nonproliferation. So Zia is going to talk briefly first, and then Pervez Hoodboy is going to talk more about the book and the current situation in South Asia. Pervez is a nuclear physicist. He's an essayist. He's a defense analyst. He also has manifold and diverse interests and accomplishments. He's been trained at MIT as a theoretical physicist, both as a PhD and ongoing work through MIT. He was a longtime professor at Qadi Azam University in Islamabad. More recently, he was a professor at Lahore University School of Management Studies. He has produced documentaries on science, on education. He and Zia produced a documentary, Crossing the Lines, on Kashmir. He wrote a great book, Science and Islam, many years ago that I think is still invaluable. So he, too, can speak on any number of issues, but here he'll be talking about the book and nuclear policy in both countries. But let me get out of the way and turn it over to Zia.
Thanks, George. Thank you, everyone. My task here is basically to help set up the book, which Pervez will talk about. And as George mentioned, I am involved in a program at Princeton, the Program on Science and Global Security. And we are a group of physicists, but we're in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. The program has been around since the early 1970s, working on nuclear weapons and nuclear energy issues in the United States and globally. And in 1997, Princeton set up a program on peace and security in South Asia. And so when it started, that program was me. It's grown over the years as the issue has become more and more important and as people have started to think more deeply about the implications of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy in Pakistan and India, and as the world, and especially the United States, has changed its relationship to these countries and these programs. So what we do in the program is to try and inform the policy debate within South Asia and about South Asia when it comes to nuclear issues. As I said, both nuclear weapons issues and nuclear energy issues. And one reason why we have taken this up as our goal is that all of us who've been involved in thinking about and working on nuclear issues in the region have realized that the debate that actually takes place within policy communities in Pakistan and India, and as far as the public in those countries is able to participate, and how the international community relates to those debates, would benefit a great deal from being more firmly rooted in solid technical and policy analysis. There's a lot of rhetoric, a lot of aspirational and normative content to those debates, a lot of propaganda, and bringing those issues more firmly down to earth and rooting them in, as best we can, scientific analysis and rigorous policy analysis, we think can help make the decisions that are made and the quality of that debate more substantial. So one of the ways that we try and do this is to bring scientists, especially physicists, from Pakistan and India to Princeton to work on these issues, because there are very few opportunities for people in Pakistani and Indian universities, scientists in particular, to work on these issues. And what Princeton is able to offer here is the fact that we have experience and expertise on these issues. We have resources, we have contacts, and so people can come and spend the summer researching and writing about policy issues that they think are important on nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. So over the period since 1997, we've covered a huge range of problems. We keep coming back to some because they're more amenable to the kind of analysis that we're able to do. So we've looked at the effects of nuclear war in South Asia and actually done detailed calculations of attacks by the two countries on each other and what that would actually mean in terms of casualties and other effects. We've looked at early warning and missile issues as the two countries have developed ballistic and cruise missile technologies, and now India is developing ballistic missile defenses. So we've actually built computer models of Pakistani and Indian missiles, flown them from reasonable launch points to possible targets, and calculated at what ranges and what times those missiles would actually show up on the other country's radar, and therefore how much warning would a policymaker actually have, and what could you do in that time? And the answer is not much. But, you know, that hasn't stopped India pursuing its missile defense program. But it has raised questions about, you know, just what do you think you're going to do with your missile defense if you only have 90 seconds? Among the other kinds of issues that we've looked at are about the problems of command and control, and especially the problems of the production of nuclear weapons material by the two countries. So on a regular basis, we produce estimates of how much plutonium and highly enriched uranium, the key materials used in nuclear weapons, have been made by Pakistan and India as part of their arms race and competition. And so it's interesting that the estimates that we publish, and we know no secrets, I mean, these are just estimates that we develop based upon our ability to model centrifuge plants and nuclear reactors, is that the government of Pakistan now, in you know, their ambassador in Geneva, says, oh, well, you know, the Princeton people say this is how much India has. And, you know, when Feroz Khan was here talking about his book on the history of the Pakistani program, in his book, the numbers he gives for how much nuclear material Pakistan has are the numbers that we produced. So, you know, we're trying to put those kinds of things out there. And we may be wrong, but and we hope that people will correct those numbers and show us how to do a better job. But that's the kinds of things that we do, as well as trying to think about how would you make progress in arms control and restraint measures between Pakistan and India if they were willing to go further down that road. Now, all this work that I've talked about, we've published it in technical journals and some policy journals. Some of you may have seen some of that work. But over the last 2 years, we thought it would actually be useful to bring all of that work together in one book. And so Pervez took on this challenge of trying to sift through all the work that so many of us have done now in the past 15 years and make sense of it and arrange it so that it tells a technical and policy story in the book about what are the important issues facing a nuclear South Asia and what some of the options are going forward. And for that, we are very grateful to him for having done this. So he spent the last two summers at Princeton working on this. He also made us update and revise all of that work so that it would actually be up to date. But so we're very grateful that he's taken on this responsibility, and I leave it to him now to talk to you about the book and some of the conclusions that he's drawn from that.
Thank you, George, for inviting me here. And thank you, Zia, for so ably summing up the book. Now I don't have anything to say. Delighted to see old friends here in the audience. Well, there's so much stuff in Pakistan that praises the bomb, that valorizes it. I have books and piles of paper. It's supposed to be the ultimate that Pakistan could have done. It's something that we had to eat grass for. I believe you had a book launched over here in Washington, D.C., which talked about eating the bomb. No, eating grass. I couldn't quite understand that because I thought only cows ate grass. If there's a sacrifice, I don't particularly see it because none of our leaders are particularly poor. In fact, they are rather rich. The bomb makers aren't poor. And so I don't see any personal sacrifices over there. So it's time for a more sober reflection on what it has meant for Pakistan and India to get bombs. And to look at the history extended over the last 50 years or more of what it has meant for the two countries. As Zia said, there's a lot of work that individual persons from both India and Pakistan have done on various technical aspects of the bomb. It was important to put them all together, put the papers together, into some kind of a coherent framework and examine this question. So the book is 17 chapters. I wish I had a copy with me, but as George explained, these are things outside of one's control. The 17 chapters, and they span both political as well as technical aspects of the bombs possessed by India and Pakistan. Let me just give you bullet points of what I think are the most salient issues today. First, I think it's pretty obvious, there's an arms race on the subcontinent. There wasn't supposed to be one. Once India and Pakistan both had nuclear weapons, well, then they'd be secure against each other, wouldn't they? Didn't turn out that way. Conventional weapons are being procured at an ever-increasing rate. Nuclear weapons are being manufactured at a still greater rate. Pakistan is supposed to have the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. Currently estimated at something like 120. Could be more, could be less, I don't know. We don't have secrets. We can only look at what's in the open literature, what people have guessed at. India's developing submarine-launched ballistic missiles and ABM system. It's got nuclear-powered submarines now, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, and there is a full-blown arms race. Pakistan is, as I said, rushing ahead. Every few weeks, one hears of missile tests, missile launches. And this is the way that it pretty much had to be. It's a repeat of the Cold War. It's not that a feeling of security would put a damper on things. There is no such thing as a minimal deterrent. The goalposts keep expanding. The reasons for Pakistan to make more nuclear weapons are, I think, important to reflect upon. As you know, Pakistan has not agreed to allow discussions on the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty to proceed at the Conference of Disarmament in Geneva. And one needs to ask why it continues to want so many nuclear weapons. Well, the old reason for making nuclear weapons is pretty clear. India tested in 1974, and that's when the Pakistani nuclear program got off the ground in a serious way. Of course, there had been a meeting of scientists in Multan, which had been at the orders of Prime Minister Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto. That was 1972, but nothing serious happened at that time. It was 74 when it got off, and the goal at that time was that Indian nukes had to be countered with Pakistani nukes. Pretty obvious. Well, by 1986, Pakistan did have the bomb. It got it a bit earlier as a consequence of Dr. A.Q. Khan being in Belgium and Holland and working at Urenco, where he was privy to secrets on the centrifuge program, brought that back, reverse-engineered the centrifuges, and 86 is pretty much when there was, you could say, a deliverable bomb. How deliverable, I don't know, but perhaps enough to be put on an aircraft. Well, that's the time when thinking started to change, but it didn't change all the way through until, let's say, the middle of the 1990s. And that's when the Pakistan Army realized that it had a protective nuclear shield. This was instrumental in the way that it then conducted its relations with India. After the tests of the Indian tests in May 1998, there was a Pakistani test 17 days later. And the enormous confidence that came about then led to the Kargil episode, which was a secret infiltration of Pakistani regulars as well as irregulars across the line of control in the Kargil area of Kashmir, one which initially inflicted heavy damage upon the Indians who were within the line of sight. But then, as the Indians responded and as things got out of hand, ultimately Pakistan had to retreat, and it was a big blow. Nevertheless, the support for Islamic militants based in Pakistan continued and continues to this day. It is because, essentially, the presence of the nuclear weapons which Pakistan has. Without such a shield, I believe that Pakistan's foreign policy with regard to India would be substantially different. And you could make the argument that India basically shot itself in the foot by going nuclear. It now does not have the option to respond to a Mumbai 2 by launching an attack upon Pakistan. To do so would then cause nuclear war to break out on the subcontinent. Let me fast forward and anticipate various questions that might be in your mind. They are partially answered in the book to the extent that these questions are answerable. Probably everyone is thinking, how safe are Pakistani nuclear weapons? My short answer is, I don't know and nobody else knows. The official answer from the Pakistani government and from the Strategic Plans Division, which is the authority of the Pakistan Army that has custodial responsibility for nuclear weapons, is that these nuclear weapons are perfectly safe, that we have established perimeter fencing everywhere that nuclear weapons are stored, that we have put electronic locks upon weapons, that they are equipped with permissive action links, and that we have instituted a personnel reliability program which will not allow any radical Islamist to infiltrate the nuclear weapons program. I have no evidence to the contrary. I, like you, I'm sure, hope that they are absolutely right in what they say. On the other hand, I have no proof that what they're saying is right. Worry remains. That worry comes about because the nature of the Pakistan Army has steadily changed over the decades. From the time that General Ziaul-Haq took over and set about Islamizing the entire country, he also succeeded in Islamizing the way that army officers thought and think about things. We know that as a consequence of that, there have developed factions within the army, or at least a faction, that doesn't think the way that the chief of army staff and the corps commanders do. Just a month ago, I was in Lahore and was told that in the cantonment area, there were big posters that were plastered everywhere. The cantonment area is where the army is. We said that General Kiani was an American agent. We also know that repeatedly the Pakistan army has been attacked in its headquarters, in its bases, and that the Pakistan Navy and the Air Force have also been victims of terrorist attacks, that these attacks have come from within. There is absolutely no doubt that when the GHQ was attacked, there were sympathizers within the army who had facilitated that. So when I say that this SPD could be right and that one hopes it is right, unfortunately, one does not have proof. And so when they say, trust us, well, I guess we can only trust them because there's nothing else, really nothing else that you can do. The United States options are essentially zero on this matter. Those nuclear weapons cannot be taken out. They are presumably dispersed at many different places. Possibly they might be in movable trucks. They are underground, according to what General Musharraf said, in places, inside tunnels. And there is no way that any country, including the United States, Israel, India, or whatever, could successfully target these nuclear weapons without opening a wide theater of war, one that would be devastating, and one in which nuclear weapons might likely be used, perhaps not against the attacking party, but perhaps against India. And so this is an option that is simply not present. Every time that this issue is taken up in the US press, it ignites a firestorm in Pakistan. And so I would strongly urge that this not be taken up. What to do, I say? Hold your peace. That's it. Well, let me move forward because I anticipate that I'm running out of time. There's a new game in town, and that game is of tactical nuclear warfare. Somewhat foolishly, I think, very foolishly, in fact, India announced a move by which it could rapidly move into Pakistan should Mumbai 2 occur. It goes under the name of Operation Cold Start. And Cold Start calls for salami slicing of Pakistan by Indian tanks and armored troop formations, but at a level that would not start nuclear war on the subcontinent. Now, how one determines the threshold for that is anybody's guess. But ever since General Deepak Kapoor announced this and said that India is capable of fighting two wars at this, India should be capable of fighting two wars at the same time, as against China and against Pakistan. Well, that set forth a huge flurry of activity within Pakistan. And today, short-range missiles are being tested. They have been tested several times. The Pakistan Army's ISPR, Inter-Services Public Relations, has said that these are nuclear capable. In time, there'll be nuclear artillery as well. After all, it's fairly easy to do that. It was done in the 1950s by the Americans. So we have now the possibility of tactical nuclear warfare in the event of a Mumbai 2 or some similar provocation. Tactical nuclear warfare opens a brand new dimension in matters of command and control. Now, tactical nuclear weapons, and this is some work that Zia had done with his collaborators, is really not a very good way of fighting a nuclear war, because a nuclear weapon can only take out so many radiation-hardened tanks. Tanks are very difficult to destroy. They might take out 15, 20, not more. And there'd be hundreds and hundreds of tanks pouring across the border, so you'd need lots and lots of nuclear weapons, which means you've got to have lots and lots of fissile material. The danger that comes about is that these nuclear weapons would be very hard to command and control safely. As it is, strategic nuclear weapons, the command and control of those involves a lot. And Whether what India and Pakistan have right now is safe enough, who knows? I don't. But when you have tactical nuclear war fighting with a common border, well, that's a different kettle of fish. So there are dangers ahead. There's need for sober reflection. And this book, which unfortunately I don't have over here, examines some of these questions. It doesn't mean that we have the answers. It doesn't mean that our facts are incontestable. At one level, every fact can be contested. But it's there. And we've tried to look at this in a sober, scientific way. So it's now up to you to read it and give your opinions. Thank you.
While Edgar is doing my time, we just have a discussion, so you know the drill. You raise your hand, and then please identify yourself and affiliation,
so that these guys know who you are, but also because you're colleagues in the audience. Who wants to go first? Start with the back there, and then we'll come up here to Mr. Russ.
Okay. My name is Stanley Kober. Professor Hoodboy wrote an article on the Pakistani army for the Economic and Political Weekly of India. I think it was almost 2 years ago, and I'm looking at it now. If I may cite a couple sentences here, two sentences. The morale of fine fighting force plummets still further when its soldiers are ordered to fight those co-religionists who claim to be fighting for Islam. The reported refusal of some military units to confront the Taliban during the South Waziristan operation is said to have shocked senior officers and severely limited their battle options in North Waziristan. Now, that suggests that the failure of the Pakistani army here is not just one of intention, but of capacity. And I'd like to pursue that further in terms of what you just said with regard to the security of the nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think it's something that's pretty well known in the army. The fact is that if a soldier or an officer is killed on the border with India, that person becomes a hero, declared a martyr. But should such an officer die fighting the Taliban, and something like 4,500 Pakistani soldiers and FC men, frontier constabulary men, have been killed fighting the Islamists, the TTP, and other factions. But their deaths are not reported in the press. They're not celebrated. They're not called martyrs. In fact, there's been sometimes a problem with their burial. Because when the local cleric is asked to perform the funeral prayers, there have been reports where that cleric has refused. So this is an enormous blow to the morale. And you can see this reflected in many different places. For example, I'd say that about a third of the streets in Lahore, a third of the streets in Karachi bear the names of some military officer who was, or some jawan who was killed in action. Action against the Indians, not against their own people. And really, this comes from the fact that the ideology of the Pakistan army over the years, over the decades, has shifted away from being a national army towards becoming an army for Islam. Now, General Musharraf tried to steer it back to the original, but he couldn't do it. Maybe he wasn't serious enough. Maybe it's too big a problem, whatever. And so today what the army says is that, look, we will fight the TTP. We will fight all those who blow bombs in public places and blow up schools and so forth. But let us have the public support. If you don't have public support, the army cannot fight.
My name is Arnold.
My name is Arnold Zeitlin, and years ago I opened the first Associated Press Bureau in Pakistan. This morning the New York Times is reporting that Pakistan apparently is using drone technology. And I wonder if you might consider this, what impact this might have on nuclear policy and the use of nuclear weapons in Pakistan.
I don't think that the use of drones would have any significant effect upon Pakistan's nuclear policy. These drones, I know, are used by Pakistan in certain places to monitor militant activity. Now, I have heard recently that in Muridke, where the Lashkar-e-Taiba is centered, that there are drones circling the sky with, well, every few minutes, every half hour or whatever. I don't know. All the time they're up there. Whether it's the Lashkar having its own drones or whether it's the Pakistan Army's drones, I don't know. But yeah, it would be important to for the Army to use drones. They're after all a prime surveillance instrument. They don't use drones with Hellfire missiles. That only you have. So there are 80 countries in the world that are using drones. I don't see why Pakistan would not be one of those.
The report he was referring to suggested that actually Pakistan now was using drones with weapons to destroy targets on the ground, and that as I'm remembering it, you know, the U.S. says it hasn't done a target, hasn't done a strike since January 11th, but there were a couple of strikes that were reported in, I think it was North Waziristan, in the last few weeks, where the U.S. is now saying, look, we didn't do it, so they're assuming that actually it's the Pakistani Air Force or somebody who's striking targets on the ground now. At least that was the reporting that was there.
Those strikes might have been by helicopters, by jets, I don't know. But having weapons on drones, that's completely different. That needs something. That needs a drone which is large enough to carry a missile that can be remotely controlled, and much more advanced electronic technology than I think the Pakistan Army possesses.
But if I can, it's worth keeping in mind that for several years now, we've seen in public these demands from Pakistan to the United States that just give us the drone technology. And you know, one of the disputes was always about that American drones were killing people that the Americans wanted to kill, which were not always necessarily the people that Pakistan wanted killed. And so there was this demand. And so one can imagine that, you know, there would be pressure in Pakistan to develop some kind of drone capacities of their own. But I think I saw the story in the New York Times also, and I'm inclined to believe that given the remoteness of the site where the attacks took place and the expectation people have now that every strike is a drone strike, that you would expect that to be the source of whatever you see happening in terms of an attack on a target, that until there is actually more, you know, real evidence from the ground of what actually took place, Pervez may well be right that there are multiple ways the Pakistan Army has already demonstrated that it can actually launch attacks on militant targets when it wants to.
In fact, just to add on to that, the size of a drone that could launch a missile like the Hellfire, smaller, would have to be much bigger than the drones that Pakistan possesses already, and that you could see from the sky.
Others, we have two here.
Hello, my name is Timothy Westmeyer. I work at the Rising Powers Initiative at GW. You spoke at the beginning very briefly about how the extent to which the Pakistani public participates in these nuclear debates. I wouldn't mind if you would expand on that a little bit further in terms of whether it be nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, or the participation of the public, their perceptions and so forth. Thank you.
There's no public participation. The nuclear weapon issue is not open for public discussion. It is assumed to have 100% public support. in one area of Pakistan, that's manifestly untrue. That's Balochistan. And you can see that because on the day that Pakistan, the rest of Pakistan celebrates the nuclear tests of 28th of May, 1998, there's a day of mourning that's announced over there. But Balochistan is a province in rebellion. In the rest of Pakistan, well, you don't see public debate. You do, on these anniversaries, there has been less and less celebration. There is a tacit acknowledgement of the fact that these nuclear weapons have not brought security to Pakistan, made the country a better place to live, more safe from its neighbors, and so forth. That's tacit. It's not discussed openly, except by, you know, maybe a handful of people who insist on putting it on the agenda. As far as nuclear power goes, well, that promise hasn't really matured. There was a time, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when today we were to have more than half our electricity produced by nuclear means. In fact, it's produced, nuclear power produces 2% of Pakistan's total energy production. And it's not going to go beyond that in the next 10 years or so. Maybe might go up to 3%, but it's pretty small.
Okay. Just to add on the public debate issue, I think it's important to put it in context. There is not a public debate on nuclear weapon policy in China. There's not really one in Russia. There's not one in France. Israel doesn't acknowledge having nuclear weapons, so there's not a debate of that. So, and there's not one in North Korea yet. But Dennis Rodman, I think the next time he goes, that he ought to be talking about that. So that's a majority of the countries that have nuclear weapons don't have debates about nuclear weapon policy. So to put it into context.
Yeah.
Let me make two additional observations about that. The first about nuclear energy. Because there are so few nuclear power plants in Pakistan, given that many protests and the beginnings of debate are around siting nuclear facilities, having only a few has reduced the number of places and communities that actually have to concretely deal with these things. Unlike in India, where we've seen large-scale sustained protests at proposed new sites for nuclear power plants and also power plants that are about to come online like Kudankulam. And we've seen, you know, massive repression by the Indian government against these protests. The second part is that this is not to say that there hasn't been moments where local communities have tried to raise these issues. There was one issue about the dumping of nuclear waste from Pakistan's nuclear program at a site in southern Punjab, which led the local community to raise this with publicly and to take it to court. And it went all the way up to the Pakistani Supreme Court. The issue was raised in Parliament.
Lahore High Court. Lahore High Court.
And Sheri Rahman, who is now the ambassador, was then a member of Parliament in Pakistan. And she raised the issue about the potential dangers of this dumping of nuclear waste in Pakistan by the Atomic Energy Commission. But despite the best efforts of this local community and their sympathizers in Parliament and in the media and so on, it reaches a point where the Atomic Energy Commission and the government says these are matters of national security and secrecy, etc., and the debate basically stops. And so that's a fundamental problem, that unlike in the United States and some other countries, nuclear energy is so wrapped up in the public and the policy process with parts of the nuclear weapons program that claiming that this is about national security and secrecy allows debate about nuclear energy to be stifled much more quickly than otherwise.
Just a quick addition to that. In Pakistan, if you raise the nuclear question, whether it's weapons or power, you are either an agent of America, of Israel, or India. In India, if you raise such questions, you are an agent of Pakistan or America.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Hoodbar. I've read many of your articles over the years. My specific question is, if there were to be an ideal sequencing of diplomatic efforts between India and Pakistan, what would they be? And, you know, if you could preface that with what you think is happening now, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
If I want to get rid of nuclear weapons in South Asia, I'd open the borders. Let Pakistanis go to India freely. Let Indians come to Pakistan freely. And that creates such goodwill. It creates the feeling that, hey, it's completely crazy to aim nuclear weapons at each other. That doesn't mean that nuclear weapons would disappear overnight. But over 5 years, 10 years, you would have less and less need to arm yourself against the other. Now, of course, then the question of China and India comes in, so it's not a perfect solution. But I'd say that the urgency to make more nuclear weapons would certainly disappear. We could then go on the downward slope, and that's the way to live together for two neighbors.
If the traffic, if that happened, if there were an opening like that, how would you guess the balance of the traffic would be? Would more people be going from west to east or from east to west?
Well, right now Pakistan isn't terribly safe, and yeah, it's not even safe for its own citizens. But that can also be made to change, because the dangers that we've created internally have a lot to do with how we've regarded India. These jihadi groups have to be done away with. There is no other way. The Pakistani state has to stop supporting them. It has to move against the TTP, which it is in a way, but not enough. And it has to stop the Lashkar-e-Tayyaba and dismantle the Murid-ke apparatus. It's got to move into Bahawalpur. It's got to stop what's going on over there. That makes Pakistan safe for Pakistanis. Then the Indians come. Meanwhile, well, this can go on simultaneously. In the long term, this is the only way that we can have peace with each other. As for the traffic, I think lots of Pakistanis will want to go into India. And yes, there are perhaps not as many Indians who would want to come in right now, but there are still very many.
Yes, the gentleman here on the row.
Hi.
Hang on 1 second. Thank you. Great.
Hi, my name is Vikrant. I'm just a member of the public. I share the planet with you. And my question is this, that, you know, you just said that the American or world media should do absolutely nothing, all right? Not a word to Pakistan. Don't do anything. Let them be. But their behavior, the behavior with the Bombay attacks, big one, is to be pardoned? What is it to be do? Like they're acting like children, but yet you're saying let them be. Why should the media, especially the media, let them be? Why should they not say some stuff to them?
Oh, maybe I didn't make myself clear enough. What I actually meant was that, for heaven's sakes, don't say Pakistan's nukes are unsafe and have it on the front pages every day. Whether they're safe or unsafe, that's a matter of opinion. But every time such a thing is published in Washington, it causes an outbreak of hysteria over there. So don't do this. It's not helpful. I don't know what to do. Maybe you have ideas, but don't do this. That's what I mean.
So it was a very specific subject. He was saying that Americans shouldn't be excoriating Pakistan. The rest of it, I think, yeah, is fair game.
There's one other thing, and that is, I'll take your mic.
And that is, like, if like, you know, with the Bombay attacks, I grew up in Bombay, all right? And if there is another something similar to what happened, and you say that there's nothing India can do, it's shot itself in the foot by having a nuclear program, okay, what is stopping the Pakistani government or where they're agency for intelligence agency who helped those fellas to come into Bombay. What's stopping them from not doing this again?
Well, I think the international opprobrium was considerable. There is also a realization that these guys are acting out of their own initiative. What happened in Mumbai was, I'm pretty sure, not at the initiative of the chief of army staff or the top echelons of the army. It did involve the army and the ISI at some level, as we know, but it didn't involve the leadership. And so there's this fear within the army that, hey, these guys can do it again, and if they do it again, then we'll be in real trouble. Remember that this is an army that's been attacked by pretty much the same kind of people itself. Not identical, but with the same frame of mind. So I don't think that the army, the high command, would want such an attack. And look, with the let's look at the last 3 years or so. Apart from these few border incidents that we've had, which were ugly, admittedly, but they were kept under control. And so there is now some wisdom that we see in keeping the temperature down. And we've now got trade with India. That's great news.
I would add to that, because it's a very good question. The question you ask is a very good one. And in deterrence theory and the literature, and there are a lot of people here who would say exactly, picking up on the point that you made and say exactly, India should have hit them back to demonstrate, you know, this doesn't pay. But what happened, India didn't respond with conventional military power to Mumbai. But then if you look at what's happened to Pakistan, Pakistan suffered without India having taken the risk of war with all of the economic consequences for India. And Pervez alluded to this. But, I mean, the international disgust over Pakistan, the disgust of many Pakistanis towards the people who did that and the possibility that elements in their state had been behind it, I think you can say that lowered support for the army and for the security services. People didn't want to live in a place that would do things like that. To the point where, you know, Pakistan lost enough that I had Pakistani officials say to me, actually, when I would bring up the issue as you did about Mumbai, and they say, oh, Mumbai, that was an Indian plot. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, no, the Indians did it. And he said, you mean like the Jews did 9/11? I said, why do you say that? And he says, well, look what happened. He says, Mumbai gets attacked, and who ends up looking bad? Pakistan. Who does everybody have sympathy for? India. So the Indians did it to make us look bad, which suggests that people didn't feel they got a lot of benefit out of it. And I think this is the point that Pervez is making. And actually, you could probably play it out and say, if India had responded with a war, the outcome could have been much worse from an Indian point of view in terms of all the consequences of that. So this restraint did cause a lot of pain and suffering in Pakistan, just not of a gunfire kind.
Well, let me add one additional thought to that, because it is important, I think, that we've also seen since then that when there have been crises between Pakistan and India on the border, the Pakistani Taliban have actually said, we will send our jihadis to fight alongside the Pakistan army against the Indians. So by Indian restraint after Mumbai, one of the things that has helped the process is that the effort to combine jihadis with Pakistani nationalism has been frustrated a little bit. Because in an ideal world, what the jihadis would like would be to be seen to be the carriers, not just of radical Islam, but Pakistani nationalism. And so an Indian enemy and an imminent Indian threat would be the one thing that would actually rally the jihadis and the army and the public, which is not necessarily a situation that one would like to see, given what that would then lead to.
I'm Frank Klotz. I'm at the Council on Foreign Relations, but before that I spent about four decades operating nuclear weapon systems. My question is, I'm going to posit a thesis, and then from a technical and policy analytical point of view, allow you to respond to it. You mentioned earlier the Indian decision to move to sea, specifically with nuclear-powered submarines. Could one argue that, in fact, this is a positive development from classical deterrence theory? Because, one, it provides the Indians a less vulnerable strike system and therefore enhances the ability to retaliate, which underpins the basis of deterrence. Also, it may promote strategic stability in the sense that it, because it is a relatively invulnerable platform, it doesn't tempt an adversary to conduct a first strike to preempt it. So from, and obviously this is the logic which the five MPT nuclear weapon states have followed, because each of them has developed, deployed, or is in the process of developing and deploying undersea deterrent capabilities. Could you respond to that?
Okay. The first thing to keep in mind is that at the end of your question, you talked about the countries that have already gone down this road. They all saw themselves possibly at war with a superpower, right? Which might actually imagine having the capability to do some of the things that you talked about, right? To be able to actually launch preemptive strikes, to think about needing the kind of secure second strike capability. It is actually an important thing to keep in mind that American notions about security of second strike and so on, and the British and the French and so on, are a consequence of the idea of who do you think you are fighting. And usually you end up imagining that you're fighting yourself. Right? That I have these capabilities, my enemy will have these capabilities, how do I defend myself against myself? Right? But in the case of Pakistan and India, they don't have, right, imaging satellites. Right? They don't have the kind of capacity to gather the timely information about delivery systems and deployments on the ground that the United States would have with regard to the Soviet Union, considering how long it took to build with so many other things. And so the first thing is that one shouldn't just generalize on the matter of, at an abstract level, from just because the United States, Britain, France, and so on did this, that this makes sense in the South Asian context, given who they're actually, the capacities that they actually are confronting with each other. I mean, I'm sure that there are people in India who have aspirations to have the kind of military capabilities that they see other advanced nuclear weapon states. But that's often because they haven't stopped to think why they have them. I mean, does India really want a capability that they imagine would be required to fight a superpower? The second part about whether this promotes strategic stability or not, I think it's actually hard to make a case that it does promote strategic stability, right? That having submarines promotes strategic stability. If you look at the deployment of ballistic missile submarines between the United States and the Soviet Union, etc., you had nuclear weapons at submarines. What did that do for all the other nuclear weapons? Right? They still kept thousands of tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. They still kept the bombers. They still kept the ICBMs. We still had crises. Right? We still had the second Cold War with Reagan. So the evidence that it actually promotes strategic stability, you know, is actually debatable. And I think that what we're actually seeing is not a strategic assessment. I think this is just a notion that this is what you're supposed to do. These are people who read Herman Kahn, they read Tom Schelling, they look at the history of the US and other people and say, okay, this is how this is done. So this is what we're going to do.
Just to add on to that, I think that in time, India will get a Trident type of capability. It doesn't have look down, it doesn't have satellites with that kind of resolution, it doesn't have geocentric ones, but it's only a matter of time. After all, they have a Mars program. Pakistan is going to continue pretty much what it's going to be, what it's been doing. They have a production line in place, both with HEU and plutonium. They're just going to make more and more warheads, more and more missiles, and then disperse them. The dispersal by itself is enough to give you second strike capability. And they're going to be placed in very in places that are very difficult to get to, perhaps at the other end of the country, perhaps in Waziristan, for all we know.
Frank, do you want to respond? Do you? I mean, you've done this in ways that none of us have. You've commanded lots of nuclear forces. You want to follow up at all? You don't have to, but I
just wanted to posit the thesis and then see what you
okay.
I agree with you.
I think there are compelling arguments on both sides on classical.
Yeah. But just before I forget, I mean, since I teach this stuff, I make my students read the old original RAND studies about the vulnerability of the bombers and the need for the missiles and all the rest of it. And you can see where this is coming from, right? That whole stream of that narrative emerges out of that, because if we could do it, then they could do it.
Others?
Yes, Steve.
Stephen Cohen, Brookings. Professor Boy, could you tell us a little bit more about the book, when it will be ready, and what's in it? Particularly, does it have any sections on issues such as nuclear forensics or the role of China in motivating the Indians and helping the Pakistanis?
Nuclear forensics it doesn't have, but that's not particularly important for India-Pakistan, I think, at the moment. It has China, but only incidentally. But it does have a lot about Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan's involvement. That, I think, is a crucial issue for us. So it's 17 chapters and a long introduction. Some of those chapters are purely technical. They relate to early warning, to the effects of nuclear weapons, to tactical nuclear warfare, to nuclear power in Pakistan and in India. The political ones are ones that deal with existential questions, questions that are presently of importance. Now, there is an argument that's being made repeatedly in Pakistan that if we had weapons in nuclear weapons in 1971, Pakistan would never have disintegrated. This is an argument that A.Q. Khan has made repeatedly. Well, what if we did have nuclear weapons at that time? Let's examine that question. The question of whether nuclear weapons help create a Pakistani nation, that's a chapter in the book. And that's fundamental, because the bomb is something that everybody is supposed to rally around. It's an instrument by which you build a national consensus. Will this succeed? Is this enough to make a nation? What is it that can make Pakistan a nation rather than just the geographical entity which today you see on the map, etc.? So,
The book physically exists, but it may be like the tree in the forest. If it's not here, we don't know that it exists. Because we're here, but we're not seeing it fall. I don't know where the hell that's going, but it's lost in transition.
It should have been here yesterday.
Yeah. So it's supposed to be here today.
So let me make one additional observation about Steve's question. That is that the book actually has already been reviewed, so somebody read it.
and many hostile reviews as well.
Well, I was going to get to that. I was going to say that, if you want, you might ask Pervez what kind of reception it had in Pakistan. But linking back to my earlier remarks about that the goal of all this is to help inform the public and the policy process in Pakistan in particular, there is actually an Urdu companion volume. Right, which is presently going through the final processes of editing and review and will be published, we hope, later on this year. The editor of that Urdu compilation is unfortunately not with us today. He's actually in Islamabad. He's another Pakistani physicist who's been spending his summers at Princeton working on some of these problems as well as the manuscript of this book. So the goal eventually is to make these ideas about the challenges and questions and problems with existing nuclear policies in South Asia accessible to as large an audience as we can try and reach with this kind of work.
Let me ask a question that was raised by... let me ask, and then I'll come back to you, Steve, but because when Pervez mentioned, it talks about kind of a Saudi Arabia in a certain context. I know a lot of people here are hearing that as a bank shot off the Iran crisis, Saudi Arabia will seek nuclear weapons, and that the way that they would acquire those nuclear weapons is through some kind of understanding or transaction with Pakistan. Either Pakistan would supply them with weapons or base them there on their behalf, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any thoughts on the calculus that would happen in Pakistan over helping Saudi Arabia to acquire nuclear weapons or stationing Pakistani weapons in Saudi Arabia? Any thoughts on that?
Well, as you know, relations between Iran and Pakistan are very poor. It wasn't that way earlier on. We were countries that were not just geographically but politically very close to each other. All that has changed ever since religion has become dominant in Pakistan. And now it's a question of the Shia-Sunni divide. So if Iran were to go nuclear and Saudi Arabia was to ask Pakistan for help, your question is, what would Pakistan's response likely be? It is not possible for Pakistan to transfer entire nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia. Even if it is done secretly by some means, it would not constitute a deterrent that Saudi Arabia could advertise. And therefore, it would not be the response that Saudi Arabia would want. However, relations between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are very close. It's a fact that people in Pakistan look up to Saudi Arabia as the place where Islam started. Saudi Arabia has given critical help to Pakistan in earlier years, in the 1970s. The bulk of the funding for the bomb, for the Pakistani bomb, came from Saudi Arabia, Libya, and the Gulf countries. Well, that's way back in the past. But presently, there are large numbers of Pakistanis who work in Saudi Arabia and send back money. And, of course, Saudi Arabia gives a lot of money in other ways, perhaps not in the best ways, for madrasas, for example. Okay, so Pakistan is beholden to Saudi Arabia. What would it do? As I said, it can't give nuclear weapons, but it can help Saudi Arabia build nuclear capacity over the years and decades. In Pakistan, there are a large number of trained nuclear engineers, the people who have worked on weapon systems. And so if Saudi Arabia was to launch a civilian nuclear program, as it has announced it wants to do, then you would need people to staff those reactors. And that's what I think Pakistan's principal help would amount to.
Steve, did you want to follow up and then go back to Dan?
No, just on this lighter point, you know, Pakistan could actually transfer nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia overtly or station some of its aircraft there, which would make it a potential target for Iran, but that's a separate issue. On the issue of nuclear forensics, there's a strong interest in India about this question, as there should be in Pakistan, because if an accident happens in either country and there's a detonation of some sort, you want to know where it came from, what happened to it, whether it was a deliberate attack. So actually, it makes sense for India and Pakistan to get together and find a third source where they could deposit some identification tracers of the nuclear capability, so that if there is a detonation, that could be opened up. So if a lockbox that could be opened up, then you could see where the weapon actually came from.
Well, you're right, but it's thinking further ahead than people have thought of as yet.
Indians are
the ticket. Okay. Dan, the fellow back in the second to last row with his hand up.
Hi, Dan Horner from Arms Control today. I forgot to follow a bit more on this Pakistan-Saudi scenario. So it seems your answer, that's over a long term, but if the response is to Iran getting the bomb, that seems Saudi Arabia would want a quicker response. I'm not sure, so explain why that addresses that point. And also, it doesn't... If all Saudi Arabia wanted was assistance in a civilian nuclear program, there are other ways it could get that. It wouldn't necessarily need to come from Pakistan. If it was a legitimate civilian nuclear program, there are international and national entities that could provide that. And finally, under the scenario, what would Saudi Arabia give to Pakistan in return? Would it be cash? Would it be some diplomatic assistance? Would it be some material aid of some kind? How are you visualizing this? Thanks.
Well, Saudi Arabia has announced its intention to purchase reactors from Westinghouse. Westinghouse would be only too happy to sell to Saudi Arabia, of course, under IAEA safeguards. The aim of a civilian nuclear program is to develop nuclear capacity. And you can do it under the NPT. You can learn how to operate nuclear reactors, deal with nuclear materials. Basically, it's all the same physics, the physics of fission. Now, why would Pakistan be involved in this? Because there are people, lots of people, trained by the Pakistani nuclear establishment who'd love to have jobs over there, and the Saudis would love to give them jobs. It would be much better to have them rather than Poles or Ukrainians or they would have to pay a lot more, and who might not be ready to do the sort of things that the Saudis would actually want them to do.
Yeah, I think, Dan, you could, following what Purvey said, you could chart out how Saudi Arabia could do this with a number of partners and get very close to a breakout capability under the current rules of the system. It'd be difficult with Westinghouse, depending on what the U.S. Nuclear Cooperation Agreement would allow on the fuel cycle side, but you could bring Pakistan in to help you on the fuel cycle side. And, you know, if Iran had done that and had been transparent about it, there wouldn't have been any violation of its IAEA relationship. So Saudi Arabia could just say, oh, we're going to build an enrichment program and we're telling you where we're building it and here's the design information and we have a Pakistani counterpart. Pakistan's not a nuclear suppliers group, so it has no inhibition legally from doing that. I mean, this is totally kosher, as it were, if they were to do it.
Well, let me make one observation on top of that. It's actually worth remembering that many of the people who were key scientists in the first generation of Pakistan's nuclear program were actually trained in U.S. labs under Atoms for Peace, right? Including Munir Ahmed Khan, you know, who led the Atomic Energy Commission through the early key years of the nuclear weapons program. So you can imagine, you know, Pakistan at some stage saying, yeah, we'll do an Atoms for Peace program for Saudis and anybody else who wants to learn about nuclear science and engineering, and we'll come and teach you, or you can come to Islamabad and into our schools and universities that belong to the Atomic Energy Commission and teach you how to make a centrifuge, how to run a production reactor. This is all 1950s vintage science that, you know, people are willing to share. And then the question is, you know, as Purvey said, capacity building.
Yes, this gentleman here.
There's Arjun.
And then Arjun, yeah.
Bruce Sugden, Cytor Corporation. Gentlemen, could you comment on how India might perceive China as a threat and how that perception might spill over and influence nuclear weapons developments between Pakistan and India?
That's a question for George.
I was looking forward to how you were going to respond to that. I mean, and there are other people in the room. I mean, India definitely sees itself in a major strategic competition with China, kind of in all domains, existentially, historically, culturally, economically, and yes, militarily, but I wouldn't put military at the top of the list. though the war they had in 62 remains a you know, source of frustration and bitterness for India, not so much in China. So it's a competitive relationship. I mean, I don't know, and there's concern about water, for example, now, and China's building of infrastructure and movement of populations that may control, water movement from the Tibetan plains and you know, into India. So there are a lot of concerns in India. You find very few knowledgeable people who say yes, and so these were acute causes of war, but there's just general concern. And so China becomes the benchmark in many ways against which India measures itself, especially militarily. And so China has a nuclear weapon capability that it's had since 64, which is expanding in number and improving in quality, evidently. So yeah, that's the standard that India kind of sets itself against. One of the reasons for that would be very natural, but one of the other reasons for it is that Indians at the same time take great pain to say they don't care about Pakistan. So that Pakistan is not the standard, and that's also for reasons that don't have anything to do with military reality. It has to do with history and culture, is that Pakistan is beneath India, and you know, India is a major power, and so it measures itself against China. So that when you go and you talk to people, say, no, we don't worry about Pakistan. China is the thing that we're worried about. And then you say, well, but why are all your divisions oriented towards Pakistan and so on? There's not a great answer for it. So it's the long-term strategic competition with China, which, by the way, helps drive the defense research and development establishment, which has always been fairly influential within India, and very unaccountable, in a sense, to scrutiny and kind of measure, including by the army or the military. So the military is very dubious about what the Defense Research and Development Organization does and proposes. But if you're a bunch of guys who want to do really cool, like, advanced weapons projects, China's the thing you have to focus on, because then you can say, you see, we have to catch up with them and have to do all this really great avant-garde stuff. And so that also helps drive this this process. And so you say, well, China's going to see more with its nuclear deterrent, and China's enhancing its naval power projection capability, so the Indian Navy has to grow similarly. Missile defense becomes part of that equation too, which isn't to say that I mean, there is a competition. I mean, and so naturally, India is looking at that with concern, and then the U.S. encourages it. The nuclear cooperation agreement that the U.S. Initiated in 2005 with India was predicated on, you know, balancing China's power and working with India to do that, and so that reflected both an Indian interest, but also kind of a U.S. encouragement that India be more overt about, not overt, more mindful of that interest as well. And India's been smart because it also plays the U.S. off with China. So India's pursuing good relations with China and the U.S., but that's all part of it, I think.
So in the book, there is actually a chapter that looks forward over the next several decades of nuclear South Asia, with a focus on the Pakistan, India, China, U.S. Process unfolding, because it's not just, as George says, not just China, India, and China, Pakistan, and Pakistan, India. The United States has become increasingly central to this dynamic. So it's not a triangular dynamic at all. And so this is actually a chapter that Pervez and I co-authored, which tries to think about what the dynamics of this four-way process is going forward. And as physicists will tell you, that the three-body problem is one of the hardest problems around, that when you have four, then, you know, life gets really complicated. But I think one of the key things to keep in mind is that the model with which you start thinking of these dynamics is important. That if you think of it as an application of Cold War dynamics, you end up with a different set of presumptions about what are the forces in play. Whereas if you think about this is an example of great power competition, that there are other things than just strategic competition in play here. So India and China have enormous volume of trade, right? There is increasing trade between Pakistan and India, and lots of Chinese economic investments in Pakistan also. And so there are balancing processes. It's not just like the old US-Soviet, you know, everything is strategic competition kind of business. It's a much more balanced relationship with these additional dimensions that all need to be kept in play, as well as the fact, central in our opinion, that India, Pakistan, and China are all seeking to develop. And so that is important also in how they think about the relative importance of some of these things that are possibly decisions that they're going to have to make in the coming future, and of course the role of the United States. And so, you know, it's a fair question, but I think, and we do try to think about it in a slightly systematic way in our chapter, but it is important to think about what is the framework within which you approach this question. Arjun.
Hi, Arjun Makhijani, Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. So good to see you both. You mentioned, you know, obviously there's a sectarian dimension to the Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Saudi financing of much that is going on in Pakistan and the tensions between. And then there are sectarian tensions one reads about here with many tragic consequences. Has this been reflected within the Pakistani military? Are there any other sectarian tensions within the military? Are there any nuclear implications? I'm completely ignorant about this. It occurred to me just hearing you speak that it was a question.
Ask the army, they say absolutely not. We are one body. What's the truth? You'd have to be an insider to really know. But Shias and Sunnis don't pray in one mosque. And so this is a very contentious issue. So the army, the soldiers have to pray. And this issue comes about. And it's not one that's easily resolved. I have met individual officers, who've been very troubled by this. And there was one who flatly refused to pray in the same mosque that General Musharraf prayed. I don't know more.
Steve.
Are you saying that in the army now they pray in separate mosques? Because when I talked to them in 85, 87... They were separate. There was no separate mosque. Sunnis and Shias were treated alike in that respect.
Steve, the problem is that you have to pray differently. Some pray this way. Shias prayed that way, with their hands down. You know immediately that guy is Shia, that guy is Sunni. It's so once you put them in the same mosque, it is very uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable in the general public. Why would it be different in the army? So it's a source of tension, and it's resolved differently in different platoons, regiments. I don't have a good enough understanding to tell you how it's resolved in different places, but I do know for sure that there are some who don't pray with people from the other side.
Yes, we're going to make this the final question, and then if you guys want to have a brief comment, you may or you don't have to.
Hi, Samira Daniels again. I really would like to push you on this issue of diplomacy because over the past 4 years, I've actually made a lot of effort to hear what the Indians and the Pakistanis at all different levels, what they say and what they may mean. And I've just been struck by the lack of rigor in the diplomacy with respect to these issues on all parts. And, you know, while you say, you know, let's open up the, you know, the opening up the borders, I understand, you know, what you're saying, but I don't think it's a sufficient, if you say it's a necessary condition, I don't think it's a sufficient condition. And I'm wondering what you, if your book addresses, you know, what can sort of bring about that rigor to this issue of, you know, better relationships between India and Pakistan? Thank you.
Oh, I don't have a magic wand, and you won't find a prescription for eternal bliss in the book either. But trade, people crossing the border from both sides as tourists, these are things that make two countries into normal neighbors. Yes, you're completely right that diplomats from both countries have view the other not as friends. But then, is that a surprise? After all, we've had four wars. Children in Pakistani schools are brought up to believe that the enemy is on the other side, and children in Indian schools, not to the same extent, but they're brought up to regard Pakistan as a hostile country. There's propaganda in the media on both sides. Now, all of this can be addressed. If you have a vision that we must live together as normal neighbors, then you take the hate materials out. At least, if you can't take them out totally, reduce their volume, make it easier to get visas. And that, by the way, was something that was happening and was briefly interrupted after this border event a month ago, 6 weeks ago. I think that'll get back on track. The good news is that in spite of the interruption because of this incident, the trade didn't really go down. And so there's a lot to hope for. We'll get there. We'll get there.
Let me answer your question slightly indirectly. And that is that the diplomacy part is not in this book, but it is in the previous book. It's called Bridging Partition. And it was done by a group of Pakistan and Indian scholars and activists who are part of this public diplomacy process between the two countries, looking at what is it that it would take in terms of building on what Pervez has said about opening borders and trade and so on. But so there are contributions by former diplomats, by former generals, by, you know, people who do education, people who do labor organizing in the two countries, and so many other things to try and actually put together concrete ideas for, as you said, taking this process step by step forward towards a more peaceful and productive relationship between the two countries. And I can give you the full reference afterwards.
I think that's the note on which we'll have to end. It's a good note relative to others. And so I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank Zia and Pervez for being here and for writing this book, which, again, I urge you to track down electronically or otherwise.